From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, an artist from Los Angeles who's inspired by neuroscience, and she's designed an outside mural for a Sacramento library. Also, one of the directors in this year's Sacramento Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. You'll meet her. And more topics today, but first, good news and not so good news. Yesterday, for Governor Schwarzenegger and the California Supreme Court, the justices ruled that last year's state worker furloughs were legal, but only because the legislature allowed them. We have analysis of this and reaction, starting with John Ortiz, the Sacramento Bee reporter, columnist, and blogger who covers state worker issues. John, welcome back.
Thanks.
Remind us how this case made its way to the California Supreme Court.
Well, way back in 2008, in December, the governor issued an order requiring state workers to take two unpaid days off each month. That eventually started up in February, but between times, several unions lodged lawsuits in the Sacramento Supreme Court. The governor eventually prevailed in the lower court. The cases were then put together and taken to the appeals court in Sacramento before the state Supreme Court took those cases up and considered them as one, asking kind of this larger question of whether governors have the power to furlough. And yesterday, as you mentioned, the ruling came out. And the fact is that no, governors can't furlough, but oddly enough, these furloughs were legal.
Were legal observers going into yesterday's ruling, were they suspecting that the justices would rule in this way? Was there a conventional wisdom about where this case was headed?
Yes, there was. I talked to several law professors, appellate attorneys, people who have argued before the court, and they all agreed that essentially neither side was going to come away with a clear win.
I see. That's John Ortiz of the Sacramento Bee. Also with us for this discussion is Bruce Blanning, who's executive director of the Professional Engineers in California Government, one of the public worker unions involved in this matter, and on the phone, Aaron McClear, Governor Schwarzenegger's spokesman. We'll start with Aaron McClear. Aaron, welcome back to Insight.
Hey, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
What does the governor make of yesterday's ruling? I mean, on the one hand, it validated his position. On the other hand, it I guess you could say it didn't.
It's a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, you know, the key thing for us was the governor did two measures last year to cut back on spending. One was the line item vetoes. You didn't mention that, but that was another thing the court ruled on yesterday, saying the governor did have the authority to make line item vetoes in the budget. And the second one was we did furloughs to cut costs as well, and the court said those furloughs were also okay. But you're right, going forward, we need the legislature's approval to do those furloughs again.
And where does the governor stand regarding the current furloughs? Because yesterday's ruling does not apply to the current fiscal year furloughs.
That's right. And that's what's going to be interesting this week. The legislature is going to unveil their budget tomorrow in a hearing, and we're going to know more about where the cuts to state workers are going to fall. Now, if furloughs are part of those cuts to the state workforce, that would need to be approved by the legislature. So I think we're going to know more tomorrow and then on Thursday when the legislature votes on that budget.
Bruce Blanning, what's your reaction to yesterday's ruling? Is it good news, bad news, or mixed?
Well, it was kind of mixed. A couple of years ago, the governor said he didn't have unilateral authority to impose furloughs, but he went ahead and did so. And after a couple of years, the Supreme Court said, yeah, he did not have unilateral authority, but the legislature ultimately, inadvertently, I think, but ultimately gave him the authority, according to the Supreme Court. At that time, he implemented the furloughs in February 2009, which was the same month that the legislature passed the budget with language which the courts had authorized the furloughs. So now, I think the question you just raised is a key one. We've had furloughs in August and September, and coming up in October, if the legislature passes a budget with the same or similar wording, does that authorize furloughs that have already taken place? Will they use different wording, in which case the furloughs this time were illegal? So there's a couple of questions left to be answered, and the budget action, if it happens this week, may not answer those questions. We don't know.
John Ortiz, do you know of any guidance from the Supreme Court regarding the current furloughs, or did it end on June 30th?
They were very specific that their ruling concerned only that February order, and they really didn't want to get into a lot of other furlough issues that have been raised. So even though this is a high court decision that in theory settles a lot of things, there's still a lot of room for litigation, and I think we may see more lawsuits. Bruce could probably speak to this better than I could, but I think it's very clear that the unions are weighing their options. Further litigation is on the menu.
Well, we will get to that in a moment. But, John, what is the difference between the current furloughs and the previous set of furloughs? Are the current furloughs effectively an extension of last fiscal year's furloughs, or is it a new set of furloughs?
It's a new set of furloughs that has not been approved by the legislature through a budget bill. And that's what makes it different. And that's why all eyes are going to be on the budget that is supposed to be unveiled this week, because the language of that budget will indicate what happens with furloughs going forward. And of course, this is happening against the backdrop of unions negotiating labor contracts right now. And my understanding is that those talks are very intense. There may be a sense on the part of some unions that they've got to beat this Thursday deadline when the budget's supposed to roll out. I think they'd like to master their own fate rather than have something perhaps imposed on them in the budget.
Bruce Blanning, will the unions be master of their own fate?
Well, we never are, so I'm not sure this is any different. There is a lawsuit which we had filed previously against the current furloughs down in Alameda Superior Court. An Alameda court had put in a restraining order to stop the furloughs based on the current situation, not the previous one. And the Supreme Court took over that case when they issued their ruling yesterday. So we're not sure what happened to the Alameda case. That one may very much be alive, and that is challenging the current furloughs. As far as mastering our own fate, we have been in bargaining. It's been kind of casual, but bargaining with the governor's office over a number of months, and we'll continue to do so. I'm not sure anything's going to happen between now and Thursday, but contract bargaining is going on.
And do those contract talks touch on furloughs?
That's one of the topics that's on the table, of course. Should there be furloughs, and should it be in the contract? But right now, there's no progress in that regard, at least as far as our union. Some of the others, as what was mentioned, are into more intense negotiations and are trying to wrap things up by Thursday.
What would your union like to see in these talks regarding furloughs?
Well, it's part of an overall
package. What kind of
rules? Yeah, there's nothing particular about furloughs any more than there is retirement plans, health plans, salaries, and so forth. It's all a mix. And so it's a matter of give and take. The furloughs can be part of that give and take if that's what we wind up agreeing to.
Do you think it's okay if furloughs happen so long as they're approved by the legislature?
Well, the legislature can approve furloughs as long as there's no contract actually in place that prohibits them. And the legislature, according to the Supreme Court, did approve the furloughs the last time around. We would not like the legislature to do that. Legislative leaders have talked about their respect for the collective bargaining process. We think these decisions should be made in collective bargaining, not legislatively.
Bruce Blanning of the Professional Engineers in California Government. Aaron McClear from the governor's office. Aaron, what's going to happen with the next with the furloughs that are coming up soon? Are they going to happen or not?
Well, we have to see what the legislature says at this point. You know, at this point, the court said the legislature has to approve those furloughs. We've saved $440 million with this current furlough program. So if the legislature does not give us the authority to do those furloughs, we'll have to make those cuts elsewhere. So that we'd be looking at layoffs or pay cuts or other things. But what we're not going to do is shield state workers from the same economic reality the rest of the state is facing. I know the union bosses would like to see them held harmless, but that's not going to happen. We're making cuts all across the board. That's going to include the state workforce.
So the governor will not be trying to push for further furloughs unless the legislature says yes.
Yeah, the governor's furlough program, this current one that went August, September, now October, is going to save $440 million. Now we need the legislature's approval to do that. We believe that we ought to do that. Now, if they don't want to do that, that's fine. We just need to look at other savings and state employee comp to make up for that.
When will the budget... Can you tell us definitively whether there will be a budget later this week?
You can't see me, but I have my fingers crossed right now. And the legislature has said that Thursday they're going to have a vote on the budget. We hope that's the case. We'd like to put this behind us. But certainly a lot of really, really bad cuts are going to be part of that. Really difficult decisions will be part of that. And an element of that budget deal will be cuts to state employee compensation. We're not going to sign off on a budget that protects state workers and hits everybody else in the state.
Will the budget include furloughs?
I very well could. That's a good question for the legislature. I think we'll know more in the next couple of days as to whether or not they give us the authority to do that. But again, it's very simple math. We have a $19 billion deficit. We need to have math that adds up to that number. And if we can't do the $440 million from this current furlough program, we'll have to find other ways to get that.
John Ortiz, have you heard anything? Are the legislative Democrats likely to include furloughs in a budget package that they would sign off on?
You know, it's hard to say. They could assume savings to employee compensation and not specify where that comes from. That's what's happened before, and that's how we got furloughs legalized. The Supreme Court said they left the door open for the governor to impose furloughs with the kind of a fuzzy language that was in the budget bill. I suppose they could do that again.
Bruce Blanning, are you and your members expecting some combination of furloughs and or layoffs and or pay cuts?
Well, I think what John said is probably likely to occur. Again, the legislature is likely to include savings in the budget, may not specify how it comes about, or they may specify how it comes about. If they said there's going to be savings, but you have to achieve them through collective bargaining, then the governor would have to actually collectively bargain with the unions. If they don't say that, the same kind of dance we've had could continue. You know, there's real savings and there's mirage savings. The furloughs, for example, in the case of our members, if they don't show up to inspect the bridge because they're furloughed, then they pay somebody else time and a half to do it. And so the furloughs really cost more money in the case of some employees. They're not really a savings. They just appear that way in a budget.
John Ortiz, I know you get countless comments from state workers in your blog and your column and through email, no doubt. What have you been hearing from state workers in general, California state workers, since yesterday's Supreme Court ruling?
Well, they're clearly not happy because one of the outcomes of the ruling is that they're not going to get back pay for wages that were lost to furloughs. There's also a sense, I think, of betrayal by the Democrats because they feel like the Democrats didn't step up for them in the hour of crisis. And now, in retrospect, they can see that Democrats left the door open for the governor's furloughs. It's ironic, I think, that if the court had ruled another way early on and the governor had lost way back in January of 2009, the ruling that eventually he won and opened up the door to furloughs, that all of the money that stacked up over time in furlough savings and potential back wages, that wouldn't have stacked up. And it's entirely possible, I think, that the Supreme Court might have ruled differently. They might have just said out and out, governors can't furlough. But because this bill for back pay had stacked up into the billions of dollars, made it very difficult for the Supreme Court, I think, to side completely with the unions. And so they got this kind of half loaf. And state workers, I think, really resent that.
Aaron McClear, final thoughts from you. Anything the governor has learned from this whole process?
Well, it has been a long process. The unions have been very successful at filing lawsuits. I think there's 30-some-odd lawsuits on the furlough issue. And we always said that the state Supreme Court would be the final arbiter, and that's what happened. And, you know, we disagreed with their ruling on the governor's authority, but we're happy that what they said was the governor's actions over the past couple of years, the line of vetoes and the furlough program, was okay. That was totally legal, and we're happy they said that.
And Bruce Blanning from Professional Engineers in California Government, final thoughts from you, including whether the union would have done anything differently, given how it all turned out.
Well, it was interesting that it took almost 2 years to get to the Supreme Court, and that was skipping the Court of Appeal. I mean, the fact is the court process is very slow, and then, as John said, the big bill builds up, and the Supreme Court was careful not to upset the separation of power between the branches by ruling that the power to furlough does not rest with the governor. On the other hand, they weren't about to hit the taxpayer for $2 billion in back pay. So they did split the baby along those lines, I think. The concern about did the Democrats in the legislature abandon state employees? No, they didn't intend anything that happened at the time to authorize furloughs. That was kind of a surprise to everyone. Now, if they do it again, it'll be intentional. But the first time around, it was just the way the court interpreted things to maintain balance of power and not have a big bill for the taxpayers.
Well, thank you all so much. In our studio, John Ortiz, Sacramento Bee reporter who covers state worker news and writes the State Worker column and blog. Bruce Blanning, executive director of the Professional Engineers in California Government. And on the phone, Aaron McClear, Governor Schwarzenegger spokesman. Thank you all for joining us.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thanks.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, author Michael Tellinger. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can email us. We're at insight@capradio.org. Small correction to something that was said on yesterday's program. Capital Public Radio reporter John Sepulvedo said Senator Dianne Ahlquist. He should have said Senator Elaine Ahlquist. Apparently, Dianne Ahlquist was John's eighth grade history teacher. Later this morning in Talk of the Nation, No Ordinary Joes, a new book about four men who survived the Depression, the sinking of the submarine in World War II, and 3 years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. The book also tells how they adapted to a changed America. That and much more on Talk of the Nation this morning at 11 on Capital Public Radio. The general consensus among scientists is that humans evolved out of other primates and that human civilization is a product of that evolution in our mental and social abilities. But some people reject that this all happened because of natural selection, and they believe that a higher intelligence intervened. South African author Michael Tellinger has explored alternative theories about human development in books like Slave Species of God and his latest, Temples of the African Gods. He's touring the US, and tonight he's in Newcastle near Auburn. Right now he's in our studio. Michael, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Lovely to be here.
How did you get interested in human civilization, specifically your theories, which are not part of the mainstream scientific consensus?
Since very early childhood, I never ever doubted that we are not alone in the universe. I always looked up at the skies wondering where all these other people are that live out there in the great vastness of the universe, and wondered what they looked like and wondered how they behaved. And slowly that grew into an interest of reading, books by people like Erich von Däniken, his wonderful exploits, and eventually ended up reading all the Zachariah Sitchin's books that deals extensively with the Sumerian tablet translations and so forth. Then accidentally, I think by design, stumbled upon a guy called Jan Heiner, who introduced me to all the ancient ruins of Southern Africa.
Which is where you're from. And what do those ancient ruins tell you?
They are a startling new physical evidence that finally we can use to support and vindicate much of what people like Zachariah Sitchin have been writing about. We're dealing with a vanished vast civilization of people in Southern Africa, which includes South Africa, Zimbabwe mainly, then parts of Botswana and Mozambique. We're dealing with an area larger than any large metropolitan area we can imagine today, that is covered by the remains of a very integrated ancient society that were mining gold. Everything deals around gold. And they were doing this a long, long time ago. At the moment, the evidence points back to close to 300,000 years.
How advanced would you say that civilization would be? Because 300,000 years ago, my understanding is that humans were not at that advanced when it comes to, forming cities and in dealing in industry and so on.
Yeah. Well, that's why this discovery is so important, because it really gives us the physical evidence. So there can be no more doubt that the fact that they lived in cohesive societies that were linked by ancient roads, which we now call channels, that were absolutely connected by agricultural terraces for thousands of miles. So whatever they were doing, we know they were mining gold, they were also not going hungry. So they were clearly planting a lot of food. There's still a lot of research that needs to be done here. But as far as how advanced were they, this is where we got to put aside all our preconceived ideas about ancient civilizations and the stuff that we find in sort of textbooks and so forth, because the discoveries we're making point to a civilization that understood the use of energy in the form of frequency.
I'm sorry, what do you mean?
Well, understanding the use of energy and sound, using sound as a source of energy, and sound emanating from the surface of planet Earth. And I know we don't have enough time here for me to go into this, but this is why I do these presentations, to show people the evidence, and it's quite overwhelming.
My guest is Michael Tellinger, author of several books with his theories and others' theories about the origins of human civilization. His latest book is Temples of the African Gods. An earlier book by you, Slave Species of God, it's a very provocative title. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, it really deals with the the evidence that we find in genetic anomalies, in the missing pieces of evidence in human history, and the gaps in you know, human evolution and so forth, that suggests that there has been an advanced group of beings on planet Earth that has...
Who are not human.
Well, not necessarily. This is where it becomes an interesting debate, because we are the genetic byproduct or offspring of these. So they're the human progenitors, one could say.
But are you saying that the general scientific consensus that we evolved directly out of other primates is wrong, that we evolved from some other kind of creature?
No. I must remind you once again that it's still the theory of evolution.
Oh, yes.
It remains
granted.
A theory of evolution, but you see, it's been sold so well as fact that people forget it and they start spewing forth the fact that it's now a fact.
Sure, evolution. but there are theories at different levels of certainty, and I think most scientists would say that the theory of evolution is while incomplete and still evolving, so to speak, is fairly well understood.
And the reason it was thought to believe to be understood is because the information that I present in my new book, Temples of the African Gods, was not known. This is brand new information. And I think when people see the extent of this, the expanse of this vanished civilization and the evidence that we present, and I'm talking about scientific evidence that we present, that it goes back to close to 300,000 years, that is the big hurdle that a lot of people will need to cross.
Are you a scientist?
Yeah, I have a scientific background in pharmaceutics.
Oh, okay, but not in evolutionary science, for example.
No, not of course. That's the stuff that I need to research and bring into. I do what the guys in CSI do. I like to look at myself like that. I go out there, I research things, I gather the clues, I gather the evidence, and over a long period of time, I put together a case and an argument for a theory.
Do you base your work on the work of people who would be considered to be evolutionary scientists of one kind or another?
Probably across all the research that I've done, there have been many, absolutely. Albert Einstein is one of them. Albert Einstein was a very strong promoter of the whole crustal shift or the crustal displacement theory, Charles Hapgood's theory. Very few people are aware of that. So, yeah, this is the information that you need to go and find among the ashes of what has been forgotten about.
My guest is Michael Tallinger. His new book is Temples of the African Gods. So is it your position that humans evolved out of a higher intelligence species that came to Earth from elsewhere?
That's what the evidence shows, absolutely. There's no doubt about it.
Meaning what? Give us an example of some of that evidence.
Well, the Sumerian tablets keep referring to it. All ancient cultures talk about it. We need to go back to the word mythos and mythology. The way we use mythology today flies in the face of its original meaning. Today it means imaginary, fairy tale, you know, made up stuff by ancient civilizations. That's not the original meaning of mythos. It means completely the opposite.
Mm. Well, I haven't read the Sumerian tablets, but there are creation myths, and as far as I understand, they often resemble each other, that you find them around the world. I mean, I guess there could be proof that something amazing happened on Earth a long time ago, or it could just be a natural psychological byproduct of the way humans try to interpret things they don't understand.
Yeah, that's what you just said there is a general kind of thing that we get told by historians, right, that people make up things. The evidence shows that all ancient cultures talk about the same number of events. The flood is, for example, one of them, the same flood that the Bible talks about. These events are commonly recorded in oral and written tradition in pretty much all ancient cultures that you study. What is important to note as well in the discoveries that we've made in southern Africa is that you can trace all other ancient civilizations, the so-called great civilizations. I'm talking about Egypt, the Sumerians, specifically those two. You can trace their origins back to South Africa and southern Africa very, very clearly with ancient carvings in rock of, for example, the Ankh, which is now no longer seen as an Egyptian creation but a southern African creation, and the winged disc, which we saw as a Sumerian creation we see in southern Africa, that are very, very old based on the rock that they carved in and the erosion in that specific rock. When you see dramatic erosion in andesite, you know we're dealing with something very, very old.
Finally, Michael, how does your theory and people who see things likewise, how does that differ from religious creationism? Because it seems like there could be an overlap there. Religious creationists believe that humans didn't just evolve through natural selection, but there was divine intervention, not just passive intervention, allowing things to happen, but directing things. Yeah. Is this a form of religious creationism?
It's absolutely. And this is what I find fascinating. You know, I've done many presentations to Christian groups and religious groups. And what I find is at the end of my presentation, they're slightly confused because they thought I was going to come there and tell them that God does not exist and all this kind of stuff. And in fact, I come there and I tell them the opposite. I tell them about how great Christ consciousness is. I tell them about how great God and the Creator is. But I draw a very strong dividing line between God with a big G and God with a small g. Just because we can clone kittens and cats and sheep, doesn't make us God. It just gives us knowledge of genetics and advanced scientific principles. So if you apply this to the origins of humankind that suddenly and mysteriously appeared on planet Earth for the simple reason of mining gold, and the evidence is overwhelming that the human race appeared on planet Earth around 300,000 years ago and went straight into gold mining. And those people that question that, please look at my new book. The evidence is there. You're not dealing with a divine being, the divine creator of the universe and all things in it. You're dealing with some advanced beings with knowledge of genetic manipulation.
Michael Tallinger, his latest book, Temples of the African Gods. He's also author of Adam's Calendar and Slave Species of God. He speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Portuguese Hall in Newcastle, which is a few miles west of Auburn, right off I-80. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Lovely being here.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, an artist from LA who is inspired by the science and structure of the brain, and her latest project is a mural for a Sacramento library. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can follow me on Twitter. You'll find a link at our webpage, capradio.org/insight. On tomorrow's show, many guests, including NPR's Michelle Norris. We'll also talk with a former Black Panther. Artist Deborah Ashheim has a degree in anthropology and an interest in how the brain works, and those scientific leanings show up in her art. Deborah lives in LA, but she's coming to town to discuss a mural she recently did for a Sacramento library. It's a tree-like image meant to suggest the branch structure of how library books are organized and how libraries themselves are organized into branches. She joins us by phone. Deborah Ashheim, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
What came first, your interest in how the brain works or your artwork?
I guess I would probably say my artwork. I mean, I've been making artwork since I was a very small child, but I've always been interested in perception and the way that people see the world. That's pretty much what led me to study anthropology when I was in college. So I'd say they're probably neck and neck, but a lot of artists have been interested in memory, perception, and thought. It's sort of part of our domain. So I think of them as kind of seamless.
Why did you become an artist as opposed to an anthropologist?
Well, I think I was really interested in exploring some of these questions about how we construct a world inside our heads and how we sort of live in that world as much as we live in the physical world from more of a first-person point of view. I think anthropology, you know, because you have the structure and the sort of large organization of the discipline behind you, you're having to say things from a kind of an all-knowing point of view. And I just wanted to have interactions that were more of a dialogue where I could see what the difference was between my experience of being a human being and other people's and sort of exchange views rather than be making kind of ultimate conclusions.
You're speaking tonight at the Robbie Waters Pocket Greenhaven Library where you did a mural on one of the exterior walls. Describe for us the mural and how you created it.
Okay, it's actually a little bit more strange than a mural. It's a LED network that's made of fiberglass and steel. So it's actually a slightly flat but fairly three-dimensional sculptural mural, if you could call it that. And it sort of seems to creep out of the doorway facing Gloria, I think it's Gloria Drive, and then it spreads across one side of the library, the side that faces the street, and then goes around the corner, and then the rest of it spreads across the other side of the building, kind of as if it was like a sort of a vine growing up the two sides of the building. And so it faces Gloria Boulevard and the parking lot. But it's called taxonomy because it's actually kind of a visual metaphor for the Dewey Decimal System. And it, in a way, it's kind of just like a giant barcode or something. The Dewey Decimal System organizes all knowledge into 10 categories. And I thought that was such a wonderfully ambitious and impossible idea to take all knowledge and divide it into 10 categories. But that's how they sort the books. And when you go and you look for a book, you're looking for something that has a number between that starts with either 0 to 900. And they've tried to organize every subject that you might think of, UFOs, the paranormal, home building, medicine, into one of these branches. And so I took a lot of the statistical information that goes into the library, how many books they had in each subject, how many books they had in technology, how many books they had in biography. And then each branch of this sort of vine-like structure is bigger or smaller or thicker or thinner or more complicated, like has more sub-branches based on how many books in the collection. So in a way, it's actually a portrait of the holdings of the books inside, but it's a glowing blue plant. So it's not really like any plant you've ever seen.
Well, it sounds very conceptual, and yet based on the photograph I saw, it's kind of a fun-looking thing too.
Yeah, I hope so. I didn't want it to just be one metaphor or one specific thing. So I wanted to have it be a blue, it's sort of a shifting color between blue and sort of aqua and green. And if you're there at night when the lights are on, you really see it change color. I wanted it to feel like it might be water or it might be a cactus or it might be a plant, because I was really interested in the way that this man-made structure, you know, the Dewey Decimal System, resembled a lot of other, like, dendritic branching structures in nature. So plants were some of them, but also the forking patterns of rivers, and on a microscopic level or just a biological level, our neural structures or even our veins and arteries. So I kind of wanted to make it open-ended enough that it didn't look like anything you'd ever seen before, but it might suggest any of these things that all sort of share a kind of structural relationship.
Yes, I think it does. I've been looking at some of your other artwork on your website, and a lot of them look to me like neurons or some other kind of microscopic element of the human body. Is that what they're meant to look like?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, usually it goes back and forth between, I'm very process-oriented in the way that I work, so I don't usually think about what something's going to look like first. I think about what I want it to mean, and then hopefully I sort of believe that through a process of thinking as deeply as I can about the ideas, it will come to look like what I want. So some of the neural networks on my website, for example, were based on, when you're having a conversation with somebody and then the conversation goes in a totally different direction and then it goes like in five other places and eventually comes back to what you're originally talking about?
Yeah, I experience that often.
And I love that. I love thinking about what would that look like if you mapped it. And actually, in your brain, when you think of an idea, it makes you think of another idea and another idea. Cognitive psychologists call those spreading networks of semantic activation. And I loved that thought of picturing what would that look like as a neural network sort of lighting up as you thought of different thoughts. And so for a long time, I was trying to map mine. A lot of my artworks are based on trying to visualize information that's kind of abstract or invisible and make it more tangible and something you can physically experience. And then I got to know some neuroscientists, and I wound up finding out that my networks actually looked like some of the images of those kind of networks when they produce laboratory images of them. So that was kind of a cool synergy.
The sort of three-dimensional mural type artwork you've done for the library in Sacramento, I don't know how long that took, but I read that some of your sculptures take weeks to assemble.
Yeah, well, anything that you do for the public space takes incredibly long because you have to go through review processes to make sure that it's safe and that it's going to be long-lasting. But in general, if I do temporary things for a museum, it can take between 2 weeks and 2 months, depending on how elaborate and intricate. And often I have, like, armies of young people helping me. I want to give a shout-out to Sign Effects, which is a a company that helps artists. It's based in Milwaukee. And Adam Brown, who's a really gifted fabricator, who actually physically helped build the sculpture with me. And I went out and worked with him in Milwaukee, and he did a lot of the hands-on. So in this case, it took I'd say about 2 years probably from the beginning of getting the idea to installing it on the library.
My goodness. Well, people will have the chance not only to see it this evening, but also to hear you talk about it. At 6:30, Deborah Ashheim will be at the Robbie Waters Pocket Greenhaven Library. Deborah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, one of the directors in this year's Sacramento Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, Calling Card, is a short film that's an ode to women with strong hands. Insight from Capital Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later today on Capital Public Radio News, a new field poll finds most Californians remain pessimistic about the state's economic recovery, as well as their own. Just 30% of those polled expect their personal financial situation to improve in the next year. Last week, there were two film festivals in town, the Modern Italian Film Festival and the Short Film Celebration, a place called Sacramento. This week, there's another. It's the Sacramento International Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. One of the featured movies is Calling Card, a short, locally made film. Director Jennifer Hatton came by our studio along with two festival organizers, President Don Deason and Program Director Michael Dennis. And I asked Don to compare the way gays and lesbians are shown in mainstream movies with how they're shown in the films in this festival.
I think at this festival what you're going to find is authentic portrayals, stories of who we are and how we really feel in the world. And it can vary between men and women and different subsets. I mean, the subject is very diverse. But when you talk about mainstream movies, you tend to see a lot of characterizations of gay men being the funny little silly comic relief and, you know, as far as lesbians are concerned, all of their problems could easily be solved if they just met the right man.
Yes.
And
but aren't most people drawn with broad strokes in mainstream films?
Well, yeah, they are because, I mean, they have to have those archetypes, don't they? That way it doesn't really challenge the imagination of the audience too much. They know what to expect. And for our film festival, I think you don't know what to expect. So when you come and see the independent films that we have at our festival, you're going to be surprised, and I think you might learn some very interesting things.
We're talking about the Sacramento International Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. It runs this week for 3 days at the Crest Theater. Michael Dennis is the program director. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
How do you choose the films? Where do they all come from?
Our films come from all over the world. We call ourselves an international film festival, and we really are. It's a process that starts January, February. We solicit films. Scoop from other festivals' lineups to see fine films that we're interested in. We also have a lot of people that send us films on their own because we're getting a little better known out there.
And what are you looking for? I mean, what helps you decide whether a film is going to make the cut or not?
Quality, a good story, something that's entertaining.
Those are good qualities for any film festival, but for specifically the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, what is it that makes a film meet what you're looking for when it comes to gay and lesbian content or who's made it?
Well, all the films have to have some sort of LGBT content, but we're looking for something that we find interesting or that we think our audience will find interesting, something that tells a story that maybe someone hasn't heard before. And we do show films that are entertaining as well.
So. Yeah. Don, could you talk a bit more about that, about what you're looking for in terms of the content? Does it need to be made by gay or lesbian filmmakers? Does it need to be specifically about gay or lesbian people?
I think anything that's true to the gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual experience is what we're looking for. A lot of our stories, I think that the audience finds provocative. There may be something that is sort of a poem that I think we can. That's how I feel about Jennifer Hatton's piece, The Calling Card, is that it's almost prose with visuals that are really, I think, really quite nice from here in Sacramento. But the other kinds of things that we have are, may touch on a subject that it's might be humorous within our community. For instance, we have a short called Chained, and in the lesbian culture, the, you know, so-called butch stereotype, a lot of the women wear these chains where they have their wallet on there, and it's just kind of part of the culture. And someone thought that was unique and interesting enough to actually go out and do a story and talk to people about why they're doing those things. So we look at things that are not going to be run-of-the-mill. You're not going to get this information anywhere else. It's very unique. And I think what makes it interesting is that the stories really do come from gay, lesbian, transgendered filmmakers. So they're telling their stories in their own way. So it's not somebody else interpreting your experience.
The film Calling Card that Dawn just mentioned, the filmmaker is with us, Jennifer Hatton. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, I watched your film, and it is kind of poetic, I guess. How did it get started?
Well, I have to credit the Queer Women of Color Media Arts Project. It's a project out of San Francisco, and it's a project that will that teaches queer women of color the A to Z of filmmaking. And it was started by Madeline Lim, who's this amazing filmmaker. She's originally from Singapore, and she found it very difficult to break into the film industry, which is traditionally a very male-dominated industry. And she found it particularly difficult as a queer woman of color. And when I say a woman of color, that includes Pacific Islanders, all indigenous people, Native Americans, African Americans, Latinos, or Latinas, I should say. And so it's been her passion, her drive to create a project that gives these women a voice, because it's a population that we don't hear from a lot. And so she's created a program that's free. And I submitted a story and was accepted into the program. And she basically provided me with the resources and the knowledge to create the film. And that's how.
When you say you submitted a story, I mean, it's a very short film. It's just 4 minutes long, and it's really more impressionistic than what one might think of as a story. What exactly was it that you submitted?
Well, the story is a story. It's true. Because of my lack of technical know-how and funds, it's kind of a bridge of that story. So as Don mentioned, it is kind of like just the prose of a story of an unrequited love, and it just happens to be from a butch femme perspective. And
it starts off with a close-up of a woman's hands, and the voiceover says something like how a butch's hands are her calling card. What does that mean?
Exactly. So the lead character is a woman that identifies herself as a butch. And for listeners who may not be familiar with that term, a butch is someone, as a lesbian woman who, as a youth, was probably described as a tomboy. And she prefers to probably wear jeans opposed to dresses, probably doesn't carry a purse, may or may not wear carry a wallet. But in any case, the lead character in this film identifies herself as a butch. And in very similar to the attraction a heterosexual woman has towards a man's hands, is they look for at a man's hands for his strength, him support, compassion. And a femme lesbian looks to a butch's hands for those same sort of qualities.
And so this woman's hands are quite strong looking.
Well, thank you. Those are my hands.
Oh, they're your hands.
But in any case, so a femme looks for those same qualities, much like a heterosexual woman looks like her. And hands say so much about a person, don't they? And so this story is really about, it's also about the power of nonverbal communication. And so the lead character understands her hands were her calling cards to a femme. And so in turn, she learns that actually a femme's hands say just as much in communicating desire and passion and commitment.
And it was shot in Sacramento.
It was largely shot in Sacramento, yes. There is a scene that was shot in San Francisco and near the Sunset Beach. Actually, it's going towards just down the hill from Robin Williams' home. So we're headed that way. He will recognize that street very well.
But there's a scene, an outdoor scene in a bar, though, isn't it, from Midtown?
It is. That's Headhunters. I really appreciate the support that I got from the establishment. Headhunters was very gracious and allowed us to film there. And also there's a beautiful sequence at McKinley Park. It was just perfect for the scene that I had always envisioned in my story. It was beautiful.
Calling Card is a short film showing at the Sacramento International Gay and Lesbian Film Festival this week. Specifically, it's shown on Friday, October 8th at 7:30 p.m. at the Crest. There are other films in it, including Don Deason, president of the festival. You Should Meet My Son. It's a feature film. It's a comedy. And I guess that's it's about what?
Yeah, You Should Meet My Son. Well, it's about this Southern woman who's rather conservative. She's just trying to find a mate for her son, so she just has a parade of these women. And he's not interested, really, because he's gay and she doesn't know that. But, I mean, this is discovered later. And she embraces the fact that she has a gay son now. She just wants him to be happy. So she goes online trying to find a mate for him. She goes out to the gay bar and just some hilarity. It's just really funny shtick kind of stuff. Yeah, it is. It's very funny, but it's the kind of thing that I think would appeal to any audience. I think it's a fun, enjoyable film. I'm really glad we have it. And correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, did it win some awards at any other film festivals?
I won an audience award at a festival whose name I cannot recall.
Another festival.
Yeah. Yes.
But Don, isn't there a risk that the conservative Southern woman could be a stereotypical character in this film? You know, the gay man might be more fleshed out as a character, but his mom might not be.
Ooh, you're very clever. Yeah, I suppose that could be true. And you know what? It probably is true, but I think the film is very gracious in that it doesn't bring to mind any of those images of a conservative, you know, religious woman who is, you know, very rigid and doesn't give to her son or gives her son a bad time, doesn't embrace the fact that he is still her son even though he's gay. So there's a nice message there about family and love.
And Michael Dennis, there's at least one feature-length documentary, A Marine Story. That's about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, isn't it?
It's not really a documentary. It's more of a drama. But
It
is based on true stories. And that was actually directed by a straight man, and his wife plays the lead character, Drea...
Weber,
thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
But it's a very, very, very good story about a Marine. You see what's happened to her her career in flashbacks, where she is forced out of the military. And it's about her accepting that and readjusting to life back home at some small town out in the middle of nowhere. It's very well done.
And then one other film out of many that caught my attention is called, it's a short film, called Door Prize, which it says it's about a two-spirited butch boy lesbian who always finds public restrooms an adventure. Meaning what?
It's a great short film. It's funny. It's got a story. It's also another story about acceptance. A woman is in Los Angeles meeting her son for lunch. He's gay. She's still dealing with that, and she's in line and meets this butch boy lesbian. They're in line for the bathroom, and the lesbian said, it doesn't matter which one I go into, because she's dressed in a tie and a jacket. And, it's just the conversation between the two of them. It's very good.
It sounds like a great scene for a short film. The Sacramento International Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, October 7th through 9th this week at the Crest Theater. One of those films, Calling Card, is a locally made short film. And you can see that on Friday evening at 7:30, along with some other short films. The director of that film is Jennifer Hatton, the president of the festival, Don Deason, the program director, Michael Dennis. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you.
This was very nice.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Estevan Hernandez, and Sosin Marar. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening. All Things Considered host Michelle Norris is in Sacramento with her new book, The Grace of Silence. We'll talk with her about it and hear about her broadcasting career at NPR. Also, candidates for Nevada's governor face off in a debate, and we'll get the latest on the Harry Reid-Sharon Angle Senate race and the history of the Black Panthers in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.